As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more 5-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain. This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today. Welcome to the Rocket Ship Podcast. I'm Michael Sacca.
And I'm Joelle Steiniger. Today we talked with David Cicirelli, the CEO of Voices.com. What'd you think, Michael?
So it was interesting to hear about how they built out early processes in their business that enabled them to scale. And they weren't often the things that you would think. It was a lot of whiteboarding sessions and cheap databases. But they made the mistakes early, and they were able to know what to do when they needed to actually implement something at scale. And so that was, it was very interesting to hear about. What did you think?
Yeah, I like that. And I like that he doesn't spin his wheels on software that's not necessary at his size yet. I think we all are guilty of that at some point. It's kind of fun to play around with a new tool and all that. But at the end of the day, you're probably doing yourself a disservice at a small size with a small team when you get away with kind of a non-tech or a low-tech version of the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So
yeah, let's get into it.
Customer.io is a modern email platform built for startups. It helps you send the right messages at the right time based on how your customers are using your app. Go to customer.io/rocketship to start sending emails that convert.
All right, cool. So David, tell us about Voices.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity to tell the story, I guess.
Yeah.
Voices.com really originated when I graduated from audio engineering school. I was a bit of a nerd and learned how to use the technology in the recording studio. I opened up a small project studio, if you will, in our hometown here bought the equipment to do so, and started recording local musicians, you know, hip hop artists, garage bands, and so forth. And actually got my name in the newspaper on my birthday of all days. And it was interesting. It turned out that Stephanie, who's now my wife and co-founder, well, at the time she was a classically trained singer. You see, she would sing at weddings and events and funerals and special events and so forth. And her mom saw this newspaper article, cut it out, put it on her bed, and said, "Hey, you should go get a demo CD done with this guy to promote your kind of freelance singing business." So Stephanie comes in, chaperoned by her mom, and we hit it off. We ended up doing this work together, her demo CD. But because of that same newspaper article, there were other local businesses that wanted a voice for their phone system. Somebody wanted to run a local advertising campaign on the radio, and they wanted a female voice. So I suggested, "Hey, Stephanie, why don't you come back into the studio, read these scripts?" And the way I tell the story is that I said that we would split the money. She never seems to remember that part, but I'm pretty sure we did. I'm pretty sure. And that kind of just kicked us off into getting into doing voiceovers. And we were doing so, you know, on a local basis, and put up a very, you know, rudimentary style, primitive website, where we started getting, you know, inbound interest from other freelance voice talent and actors and broadcasters saying, "Hey, if you need a guy who speaks French, or you need somebody with a booming baritone, or you want somebody with a British accent, then, you know, I'm your guy or gal, and can I be on your website?" So we started listing these names, and that was, you know, I guess, you know, the aha moment was, well, if we're listing all these talent, they're located all around the world, why don't we, instead of just kind of promoting this small little recording studio we have in the city, transform this into a marketplace where on one hand we have, you know, we had a few dozen talent at the time, and then, you know, our whole modus operandi would be, how do you get these talent work? And so we, you know, did the proverbial pivot, as they say, right? And we sold all the recording equipment that I had, probably, I want to say, about $15,000, $20,000 worth, reinvested that in hiring a developer to take what we built ourselves into, you know, a full-blown database and a web application, and then launched what is now become voices.com.
So you guys have, the voiceover industry is you know, decades old.
Yeah.
You guys come in with a new model. You've landed some fantastic clients, seeing from your website, NBC, ABC, PBS. How did you convince them to use your platform over what they were probably, how they were sourcing before, maybe through agents?
Yeah, for sure. And I think what was really amazing is that it's really no different than any other market. A prospective customer has a problem, and if they ask their friends and maybe family members, or you ask around, and if no one has a good recommendation to you, what do? We go Google it, right? If that's not mm-hmm. the default choice in the first place. And right from the beginning, I mean, before, you know, SEO was really a thing, I was just knees deep into this because I knew that there was tremendous power in going where the people were looking, and they were all looking on Google and Yahoo at the time, and trying to figure out how do we get in front of them and draw traffic to us. It was also the earliest days of the Google AdWords platform, and so, you know, we advertised quite heavily early on, which was costing like 5 cents a click, like whereas now that might be $5.
Right.
So, you know, traffic was just dirt cheap. And so kind of bringing the traffic to us in terms of an acquisition an attraction in the first place, and then presenting a kind of a compelling message. I mean, we had really great sounding talent and enough of a critical mass, which, I mean, it's not even a critical mass. I mean, we had a few dozen, as I mentioned, where we created these little mini profiles. I mean, this is way before LinkedIn and Facebook and kind of social networking, or even having a profile on the web. So the talent were presented in a professional manner, and that's all these clients wanted. They just wanted to find a simple way to hire somebody to get the work done. And Voices has always been a utility for that reason. People aren't spending hours on here poking around for fun. It's because they have a project they need done and typically a looming deadline. And so a web marketplace, an online marketplace, really kind of feeds into that, to meeting those needs in a timely basis. And I think it's that fast turnaround time, the access to the talent quickly, was what won us, which, you know, won us some great relationships over the years.
So we talked before the call about kind of some of the things that you can do as an entrepreneur to get ready to scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to hear, it sounds like this grew very organically, but I'd love to hear kind of your insight on what entrepreneurs can do when they're getting started to make sure that they don't hit some of those roadblocks.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, as founders, you know, Stephanie and I mean, it's certainly not necessarily recommended for everyone kind of being, you know, married and co-founders. There are some great success stories along that front. But one thing I think we got right was, you know, on the upside, you know, we live, breathe, eat, and sleep this business. But we also defined our, literally like our job description. I just remember clearly getting out a piece of paper, putting a line down the middle of it and like, okay, Steph, what do you want me to do? And what do you think you're really good at? And here's what I think you're also really good at, those things. So you can own that, those aspects of the business. And by having those, you know, delineations early on as either co-founders or an early early employees, that is going to eliminate a lot of questions, arguments, long meetings about who's doing what, when, and where, and why, by getting basically it down on paper, areas of responsibility. So I think that set us up for longer term success. The other piece that kind of fell out of that was having a system or a series of systems, if you will, that that supported each of those roles. So, for example, with us, we, like way back in the day when we first got started, I mentioned these kind of two dozen voice talent that we had listed. We just had a giant whiteboard and we wrote everybody's name down on it. And so whenever we would get an email inbound from a new customer or somebody that might be interested, we literally just kept it not only top of mind, but like right in front of our faces on this huge whiteboard of who both our existing customers and maybe potentials would be. And by having, you know, and that kind of led into, you know, ultimately getting it into some type of a database, which was initially a shared Google. It was actually, sorry, it was called Microsoft Entourage for Mac. It was actually pretty bad. And then that led into like software as a service after that. So, you know, when you define the roles and responsibilities, I mean, broadly speaking, I was always responsible for the clients or the buyers of voiceover services. And Stephanie was always responsible for the talent and promoting them and educating them on how to do work on this platform. And so that led into, okay, well, each of us are responsible for the systems that go to support those areas of responsibility. So yeah, hopefully that makes sense.
When Rainn Wilson realized he had a special gift for talking people to sleep, he had two choices: construct a massive speaker that would blast his voice to every person in the country, or invent a talking pillow. AT&T Business eventually talked him into the pillow thing. And, backed by a reliable network, the only network with built-in security controls, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your ideas to the moon and beyond at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. This episode is brought to you by Yahoo Finance. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all of your investment and retirement accounts in one place? With Yahoo Finance, you can consolidate your views with multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Honestly, this has been a lifesaver for me. I've used Yahoo Finance to consolidate all of my various 401k and investment accounts so I can see everything all in one place. And it makes it incredibly easy to manage. So if you're struggling with that, check out Yahoo Finance. For over 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including your 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart a great investor, and that's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. So go to yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. Yeah, well, typically when we talk about scale, right, we're like future-proofing our code base.
Totally.
Or we're preparing for a million users. Yeah. Why do you think that this kind of works instead? Because, I mean, using a whiteboard or a poorly structured database, you can't do that at a million.
No.
But how do you see this helping you scale in the early days, and why does it work for you?
Yeah, I think it's because you can make mistakes on a small scale that don't amplify into an enormous disaster. So, for example, how to handle duplicate records. What's your unique identifier for your users? Is it a username, or is it an email address, or is it some number? That would be one example. And you can figure that out basically with a spreadsheet when you have maybe hundreds or thousands. But when you get millions, it's just a complete disaster. So I think you can solve those. One, identify what the potential problems are in a really controlled environment before you are a lot bigger. And then when it does come time to looking at, speaking to scale, when we ultimately selected a customer relationship management system, so we use Salesforce. I mean, we signed on to Salesforce in 2005. I mean, they were a very, very young company, way different than they are now. No partners, it was really, really quite different. But we believed in the vision, which was, hey, we can add employees on quickly. Theoretically, this thing, we can have tens of millions of records in here. So the thought that goes through my mind, and there's an article I wrote about on this called 10X Thinking, which is basically a hat tip to, I believe Grant Cardone has a book on the same concept. But when building something, if you're going to bother, after you've gone through the no tech and then some low tech, and then you've like selecting a system, select something that's, 10X bigger than you need at present. Or maybe even 100x. Now, it really shouldn't be that much more expensive. It's just build something that is expandable, that can scale relatively easily. I mean, Amazon's S3 services, or Salesforce, I think, is another great example. Or, running your email through Gmail and using the Google App Suite. I mean, those are all things that are infinitely scalable, theoretically, but that can really handle your company going from zero to you being a hero in your space. And so that's kind of some of those rules of thumb that I use, is like 10x or 100x thinking when it's the right time to like actually invest in something that's going to help you get big.
So is your philosophy to kind of use the lowest possible tech solution until it just hurts so bad you have to move on to the next rung?
I would say so, and while it might seem counterintuitive, I think you can actually move faster, because otherwise you just get caught up. I mean, look, if we're talking about product, I mean, you don't want to compromise on your product. But if you're talking about like, oh, how do we handle, vacation day requests in the office, or how do we handle the ordering of our coffee supplies, or, these kind of things don't need complicated solutions at the beginning. Otherwise, you're over-engineering every single aspect of your business, and the only thing that should be engineered to that degree is your product. So we really try to keep things ridiculously simple. I mean, there's a system, and there's a method to the, not that it's madness necessarily, but there's certainly a method there. But I just think when you can make something tangible and visual, like using sticky notes and whiteboards and, physical reminders, to the point where that's breaking down, then the question becomes, how do I digitize this? How do I get it into a computer? How do I make it flow without me approving everything, physically? Then I think you're ultimately going to make smarter decisions. It's slower at the beginning, but then it's faster in the long run.
No, it makes sense. You make cheap mistakes, I guess, is
totally.
Kind of.
Totally.
Yeah.
And we talked earlier about, you know, I think there's a notion that, you know, oh, our company could be 100 times bigger if we just had a $10 million investment. Well, you pour $10 million on, you know, your $500,000 a year revenue company, you're going to make way more costly mistakes because all you've done is just amplify that. That's what money does. It amplifies what you're already doing. Mm-hmm. And if you're not doing the right things when you're small, they're going to be painfully obvious when you're that much bigger, because so you spend your investment on acquiring more users. Well, if you have a terrible onboarding process and a brutal product and a challenging way to do, you know, customer service, all those are going to be like issues are going to be screaming at you. And then you're just going to feel like you're treading water and never really, moving ahead in a meaningful way.
Do you have any kind of rule of thumb of for what young founders, where to start, right? So like, are there different things that you say, spend your time over here, but do this cheaply and effectively?
I think rule of thumb, I think you need a great customer system. I mean, only speaking from experience, I would say an amazing financial system, because that's an amazing customer system. Those are the two bedrocks. I mean, everything else is built on those. You don't recognize that at the beginning. You're like, I mean, we used QuickBooks. We're like, oh, this is fine. This is no problem. Until you get to that point where a small business, if you're thinking about doing automated transactions and most kind of online platforms of any degree would be, you should be thinking about that. Think about how you're going to handle customers. That's what I've never really understood, you know, and it's just not my space, which is, you know, maybe my lack of knowledge here. But, you know, if you're encouraging someone to download, use your app, I would want to know who that person is and be able to engage them over the long run. So I just, you know, I think having a great customer system that does everything that allows you to do marketing, sales, and service or support. And then when there is a sale, you know, how are you actually handling and accounting for that financial transaction? Those are the two biggies that we did the CRM very, very early. And I think we could have done better on the financial system. We got in the right place. It was just, we probably waited too long. So I think if there was, you know, a rule of thumb of two areas that are going to be operational to some degree and supporting your business, I would focus on those to get those right early on.
Do you think people worry about scale too early and like end up spinning their wheels thinking about how are we going to handle this massive scale when in reality
totally.
That's kind of way off in the future?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the best thing to focus on is, you know, I mean, even to talking about these systems, I mean, have an awesome product. And, you know, I've read a lot about, a great product is the best marketing that you can have. And I totally believe that because that's going to be the kind of thing that people use. And they don't just download it once and use it once. You want to figure out how to become part of somebody's day. And that's what defines a high usage product. And when you look at something like, you know, Skype or, you know, Facebook or LinkedIn, I mean, these are apps that people, you know, and platforms people are using multiple times per day. So that's the sign of a great product. Voices, you know, our talent are doing auditions 10 times a day. So they're constantly being brought back to the website to submit an audition and be in consideration for those job opportunities. So, you know, some people call that, you know, stickiness. I would consider that usage rather than just somebody hanging around using my, you know, looking at my app. I want somebody to actually use it as part of their day. So that's the first place and get that right. And there's some simple ways to know if you're on the right path. I mean, we grew slowly but surely, but we did so because we always asked for customer feedback, literally not through, you know, surveys and just kind of like, you know, from a distance. Literally, we went and met with customers. We picked up the phone and asked you know, perceived industry authority figures how we should do things. I mean, it was a phone call, and someone's going to be willing to give up some of their time, you know, to be able to, you know, pass some knowledge, you know, along. I mean, if you want to go all out, you can give them a, you know, a nice gift basket or something on, you know, as a, you know, a token thank you, on the end. I mean, that stuff's meaningful, and you can get pretty significant, endorsements, and just clarity over if you're transforming an industry or the way it was done for the last 20, 30, 40 years, and you've got a new solution. Ask people, what's your biggest beef with how you're currently doing business or the way the industry works right now? And then you can say, well, if I could do one thing to knock your socks off and change that, what would that look like? And and just let them talk. Speaking of kind of, I mean, it's relatively low tech, is that we installed this toll-free telephone line into our home office, really. And this phone would ring all the time. People didn't know if they're calling into, you know, basically a two-person operation in a dinette in a condo, or if they were calling into a Fortune 500 company. We had, you know, Stephanie had her nice voice doing the greeting on the beginning of this phone. But because it was a toll-free phone number plastered at the top of every page on our website, we figured it was cheaper to drive an inbound call than to us constantly doing prospecting outbound. And when people called in, we would ask them straight up, how did you find us? Why did you choose to call in? What prompted the phone call? Hey, if we could do something, I just wanted to show you something quickly, maybe a page you hadn't seen on the website. Does this make sense to you? You know, talk me through it. And we would basically be soliciting customer feedback from those inbound calls to constantly be making the product better and easier to use. So I wouldn't underestimate the value of a phone call, I guess, is where I'm going with that one.
So what's one surprising thing you've learned from managing a marketplace for the last several years?
Yeah. That you really do need to have an equal balance between the buyers and sellers. And you can't, like, and this is, you know, as they call us often, the chicken and the egg problem. You need enough sellers or service providers or enough, you know, product listings or whatever, you know, what have you, in order to attract somebody who might be wanting to buy that. And so you need the variety and variation in order for their buyers to kind of bother showing up. We just did that really small at the beginning, and we split granted, it helped that there was two of us and each of us were focused on building up our own kind of sides of the business, but we always supported each other. We always, like, not that, it was certainly a healthy degree of kind of competition of, like, how many buyers do we have? How many talent do we have? And making sure that our ad spend was in tandem, our email messages, newsletters were done differently for each side of the marketplace, that the messaging and, like, blog posts and everything was done and tailored for, dependent on kind of what user type you were, and that they were given equal attention. Even to this day with, you know, well over 250,000 users, it's a surprisingly close split. I think it's like 48-52. Like, it's very, very close. And I think that's a testament to our determination to not let one side of the market get wildly out of control.
Have you had to control both sides at different points?
Yeah, I would say more recently we've been putting a greater emphasis on the buyers, simply because in this situation, when you do have, I hate to use the term, but kind of this critical mass of talent, I mean, whether we had, 100,000, 120, 150,000 talent, I mean, it's not making a huge amount of difference. Certainly we would love to have great people who have great voices and, you know, if they want to sign up, then by all means. But in terms of our sales and marketing efforts, they're at this point heavily skewed towards attracting the clients. And the reason should be fairly straightforward and obvious to those listening, that if you bring the people in effect with the money, then you're always going to have supply there. You know, we're trying to, it's a demand-driven marketplace. So you want to tap into that demand. These people are going to be spending it somewhere. If they could just bring and shift those dollars over to voices, then we know we're going to keep our population or our community of voice talent happy. They're going to continue to stay engaged because they're getting work. And that has its own like viral component because they get work, they go to a workshop or some acting class or lesson, or they're in a studio with someone else and they say, hey, well, how are you getting your work nowadays? Oh, I'm using this this site called voices.com. Oh, that's interesting. I've heard good things. Should I sign up? Well, you might as well give it a go. It's been working for me. So If we can continue to basically, the talent community already talks with one another, and we've got that whole, you know, we've really kind of tapped into that. The buyers tend to be more independent, so it just requires more effort to introduce our service and you know, encourage them to transition how they're doing business.
Have you ever had a buyer who wanted voice talent but you didn't have any talent for their need?
Oh, I feel like it's usually around really I would say like an obscure language. I mean,
okay.
I mean, not to put you on the spot. I mean, if you were to guess, how many languages do you think there are in the world?
150, 200?
6,000.
Wow.
Right? So most of them are spoken by like indigenous people groups.
Okay.
Because, you know, you think, oh, well, there's like, you know, United Nations says there's like 220 countries in the world. And maybe, yeah, there's some countries speak multiple languages. But... you know, you go to like Indonesia and there's all these people groups that might, they have these languages that you've just never heard of. And there's, I mean, you can look that up on Wikipedia. There's like a whole, you know, listing and so forth. And sometimes we get, we're like, I don't even know, you know, and they're not necessarily going to have voice talent in those because there's not even a broadcasting mechanism amongst the people that speak that language. So it's, you know, sometimes we get these very challenging requests like that, but celebrity impersonations or like, I want a hero sounding voice or a, you know, a villain or a cowboy or a surfer dude. Like, I mean, those are pretty straightforward. Any kind of archetypes, that's no problem because it's acting, and actors, if they can't come up with the voice, you know, if you don't exactly know what it is, then you make it up. Like, okay, it's a monster. Well, what do you want a monster to sound like for your crazy video game? You know, it's like Gollum in Lord of the Rings. I mean, that has a very distinct thing. But before that, you wouldn't have thought that this little goblin character might have sounded just like that. But now everyone can kind of associate that. So, yeah, great question. I think it's been more around these very, very obscure languages, though.
Yeah, no, very cool.
You learned something new, didn't you?
Yes. So where can we keep up with you and voices online?
I think the best place would be actually on, on our website, of course, www.voices.com, a great simple domain name that sums up what we do, in a single word. The other place would be at voices on, Twitter. So, that's kind of on the company. Anybody wants to email me or have questions, I'm always willing to answer those, maybe, tell you a quick story about, or point you in the right direction, or even give you a resource of how we've been able to grow the company. Best place to reach me would be by email. So it's david@voices.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, David.
Hey, great call today. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Rocket Ship Podcast. If you enjoyed it, we have tons of other awesome episodes on our website. Check them out, rocketship.fm.
And be sure to check out our app discount section, where we have discounts on products that we use every day, like Woo Themes, Wistia, Treehouse. Go to rocketship.fm/essentials and get your discounts today.